From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. Our program today is about birds, and for that, I'm speaking with two experts from Cornell University. The prestigious university is located in Ithaca, New York, and among its claims to fame is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. The Cornell Lab is actively engaged in protecting and conserving bird species of all kinds from all over the world. Many of the birds are endangered, and some are in serious decline. The reasons are varied: loss of habitat, loss of food source, and in some cases, hunting or trafficking of birds. Joining me now is Eduardo Inigo Elias, a PhD and Senior Research Associate of Conservation Science at Cornell University. Eduardo is an expert on endangered birds in Central America, especially parrots, which are often captured alive. He joins me now by phone from Cornell. Welcome, Eduardo.
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you very much for your introduction and for inviting me to your program.
No, I'm very happy to have you. Well, a lot of people know the story of the dodo bird that went extinct several hundred years ago in its only habitat of Mauritius, or the Carolina parakeet of the eastern United States that died out in the early 20th century. They were mostly hunted to extinction. But Eduardo, some birds are captured to be pets. How prevalent is that?
Well, this is a long history, a history from the human interaction with environment. And, you know, we have records from the Egyptians, from the Romans, from the Aztecs, from the Mayas, from the Incas. The people love to keep birds in captivity, to be close, to see the colors, to see the behavior, to keep them in cages, or in some fashion also to keep the birds as part of the decorations. You know, back in the 1900s in Europe and in the U.S., there was a huge trade of dead birds, from hummingbirds to egrets, for decoration of the hats. And that fashion of keeping the feathers in the hats or part of the bird with a bill and created an amazing impact on the bird populations around the world. And thanks to the education and thanks to the changes and thanks to the conservation efforts of many people, the trade was banished and the fashion was removed, and many of those species used for the hats were stopped. But as you mentioned, they continue in another way today.
And you are particularly partial to parrots, I understand. So if we go to a pet store, say in the United States or in Europe or elsewhere in the world, you might buy a parrot or a singing bird or some kind of bird, but surely a wild bird caught in the wild and taken from its habitat, you can't just easily keep it as a pet, can you?
No, it's very difficult to keep wild birds in captivity, for several reasons, particularly parrots. Parrots are one of the most social species in the avian world. They interact with each other. They get together in large flocks in the environment, in the jungles or tropical forests. And some of them love to spend time in groups where they are socializing, in preening, you know, playing and cleaning their feathers to each other. But also one of the things that people do not understand is that parrots, macaws, parakeets, tend to live really long, long lives, sometimes even longer than the owner of the bird. And that creates a commitment to the people to keep those birds in captivity. And that creates troubles also, because when a parrot or a parakeet or macaw is not taking care by the person who has been keeping this bird in captivity, tends to go into this aggressive and destructive behavior, turning in pieces the house, turning in pieces the fingers of some other people who try to play with the bird in the house. And that's very common. And so if you are thinking about keeping a bird in captivity, and particularly a parrot, you should be careful what are the choices that you're making. And also today, it's easier to keep birds in captivity if you know that they are coming from a captive bred facility, which it's very easy to identify the birds because they come over with bands in their legs, and those bands are close, so you can see that, and they are certified. But in many other parts of the world, the trade continue. But thanks to the enforcement of several international legislations like the CITES, the Convention for the International Trade of Endangered Species, the trade of some species has been reduced dramatically, among them the African gray parrot, the yellowhead parrot, and other species of parrots that in the 70s and 80s were exported around the world in the millions. And that has stopped thanks to this enforcement and education.
How much does the wildlife trafficking affect the viability of a particular species in the wild?
Well, this is one of the things that is very particular depending on what species are we talking about. For example, large species such as macaws, like the scarlet macaw or the yellow-headed parrot, those are some of the species that have been traded for centuries, probably 200 years or more, for the international pet trade, for live animals harvesting in the wild that are shipping to other nations or within the domestic national trades of the countries where they are trapped. And that has decimated the populations because, as I mentioned, and is well documented in other species that are highly sociable that have gone extinct, like the passenger pigeon, if we don't keep populations in the wild with large flocks where they can interact, then what can happen is a social disruption, a disruption of the behavior of the parrots in the wild, and the species become, in the long term, extinct. You are reducing also the genetics of the population. You are reducing also the survival of the parrots that know where to breed. Because when you are in the jungles in Central America, in Africa, and South America, where they trap these species, normally they are destroying the nesting site. And as I mentioned earlier before, many of these species are birds that have a long life, 60 years or more. When you destroy the connection between some of those parrots, they are stopping to breed and reproduce and introduce new individuals in the population, and there becomes a major crash.
Is there a particular part of the world that is especially egregious? I know the United States has been pretty aggressive in prosecuting wildlife smugglers, and birds in particular, also reptiles, but birds. It's just bizarre to read about birds being strapped to somebody's leg coming into the country, and they're the ones that make it alive. Fortunately, in some cases, have been caught. But are there areas of the world where the birds are originating from?
Well, this is a very complex question because the wild bird trade is a very complex human endeavor with many environmental, social, and economic corners or areas that we can see. And it changed in a dynamic kind of a trade or dynamic part of the human life. You know, 100 years ago, back in 1906, the U.S. was importing thousands, over 800,000 of wild birds from Europe, from Latin America, for the pet trade. And this is well documented on the cage bird traffic by a biologist, Henry Aldiss, back in 1906. And these collectors or aviculturists with the desire is to have the most rare in their hands. And typical examples of these are the black palm cockatoo from Papua New Guinea and Australia that have been almost extinct to the pet trade. One of those individuals in the illegal pet trade in this country and in Europe, a bird can go up to $30,000. Another species that was extinct in the wild, but is well known that is in captivity in populations by these aviculturists and people who are passionate about keeping them, is the Spix macaw from Brazil, who was eliminated and extirpated from the wild and now is more than 30 individuals in captivity in different parts of the world. And there are some efforts to try to breed them and introduce them back in the wild. But what originated the problem was the greedy, the need to keep them in captivity rather than enjoy them in the wild and helping to conserve wild populations.
There are also birds that are not alive. So you have a particular affinity for parrots. I love hummingbirds, and I was really disturbed to learn about the hummingbird trade used as part of a love spell, I understand, in parts of the world. So tell me about that. Are there some hummingbirds that are protected under this, under the CITES or the Endangered Species Act?
Well, as I mentioned earlier on the issue of the hats, and when back in the 1900s, in the Victorian times, when it was the desire to keep birds in the hats of ladies in Europe and in the U.S., millions of hummingbirds were captured dead in South America for the fashion trade. For centuries, another trade had existed in Central America, particularly in Mexico, where is a trade domestically primarily of hummingbirds for keeping them as a kind of a symbol for love. And it continued into a very, very small scale until the last couple of probably 10 years or less, when it was discovered as another fashion. And now we're finding in the border in the U.S., and as it was recently published in the National Geographic in the month of in April, a large numbers of hummingbirds, particularly from Mexico and other parts of Central America, are being exploited and imported into the U.S. for this type of human activity. The other thing that was mentioned is that thanks to the efforts of the U.S. legislations like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1906 that today is in peril in Congress because it wants to be changed and remove some of the parts, all these migratory species of hummingbirds from North America are protected both in the U.S. and Mexico because both countries are signatories of the treaty. Another important thing to know is that all hummingbird species are included in the CITES, in the Convention of International Trade of Endangered Species, and that restrict the trade and help to monitor the countries, the trade of hummingbirds.
What I want to mention, is just because I think it's important for people to understand that birds are not just beautiful and we don't just enjoy them visually. They are pollinators like bees.
Exactly. Birds have many functions in the environment. And one of them that you mentioned now, hummingbirds are one of the most important pollinators and they are part of the network between Canada, U.S., Mexico, and many other countries of the conservation of pollinators. And hummingbirds are only in the what we call the New World or the Nearctics and Neotropics from Canada and Alaska all the way down to Patagonia. And they go from sea level to the top of the Andes, more than 4,000 meters above sea level. And in the Caribbean, we have in the island of Cuba the smallest hummingbird in the world with less than 2 grams. And in Brazil, we have some birds that are close to 200 grams. You know, it's a very wide group of hummingbirds or birds with over 300 species.
And I think the more aware people are of the danger of losing these beautiful creatures, the better off.
I didn't mention many of the other legislations that exist in the U.S. that are also important, but, you know, it's the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the Wild Bird Conservation Act, which was passed in 1992, and thanks to that legislation, all over the world has made a major impact to restrict the trade. You know, we are in much better hands today. I didn't want it to sound like a negative, but we're in much better sound today than what was in the 60s and 70s with the international bird trade.
Well, thank you so much, Eduardo, for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I hope this information is helpful, and let me know if you need additional materials, and I will be happy to send you.
Absolutely. Eduardo Inigo Elias is a PhD and Senior Research Associate of Conservation Science at Cornell University. We'll get back to Press Conference USA in just a moment, but first, a reminder that you're listening to PCUSA on the Voice of America. Did you know our podcast is available for free download on iTunes? You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And here's a shout out to Zahid Khan Jigani of Peshawar, Pakistan, a listener and Facebook fan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on our webpage at voanews.com/PCUSA. Now back to our program about birds. As I mentioned, Cornell University's Lab of Ornithology is actively engaged in protecting and conserving birds in their habitat all over the world. And to help them do that, they rely on hundreds of thousands of bird enthusiasts across the globe to participate as citizen scientists to track the number and kinds of birds they see in their own neighborhoods, whether they live in Lusaka, Zambia, or Mumbai, India, or here in Washington. Well, joining me now to talk about that is Ian Davies, the eBird Project Coordinator at Cornell University in New York. Welcome, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I understand that 2018 is the year of the bird. So what is Cornell's eBird Project, and how does it give us a better understanding of birds and their migratory patterns?
Yeah, so 2018 is the year of the bird, and it's something we're really excited about, kind of this global celebration of birds and what they offer us and the world. eBird is kind of a way to take the global interest that people have in birds and use that to collect information on where and when birds occur across the entire planet, and then use that information for research and conservation.
So how important is citizen science in tracking birds? I mean, what are some examples of what has been gleaned from the research that people across the globe have been helping you with?
Citizen science is really critically important. It's something where around the world, the kind of traditional scientific approach has been to come up with a specific research question and kind of pay technicians to go out and collect the information. But that doesn't really scale across the entire world, where you can't pay everyone. And so citizen science kind of taps into a passion for a subject that people share and gives them a means and kind of a drive to go out and collect information on really what's important. So for birds, we collect information on where and when they occur everywhere in the world.
Are you tracking kind of migratory patterns too? So from like here in North America, from Mexico to the United States, we have a number of migratory birds coming across the border and also from Canada down to the U.S. During other times. Are these kind of patterns that you're also tracking, not just what they're seeing, but tracking movements?
Yeah. So the exciting thing about a broad group of people collecting information is that you can really collect information on where birds are and when they're moving. So if you have 100,000 people that go out and just report what's in their backyard, just a simple sighting, you can understand maybe this week a species of magnolia warbler is occurring in the northern U.S. as reported by 20,000 people. The next week, the people in the northern U.S. aren't reporting it anymore, but now everyone in the south is. And so by collecting information from a broad variety of people, you can really understand how birds move.
How many people have logged on to your website for the eBird Project? How many people have logged on and reported back what they've seen? And how many countries are involved?
The thing that we find continually amazing and inspiring about birds is how they really bring people together around the world. So to date, we have about 410,000 people from every country in the world who have contributed information. Actually, more than 500 million sightings of birds are now freely available through eBird.
And what's the most surprising information that you have seen from the eBird reports? Are there sightings of rare birds? Are there sightings of fewer birds than you expected, more birds than you expected?
Yeah, there are so many exciting stories to tell. And so there's everything from understanding things about common birds that we never really knew before. So conservation will often be focused on maybe the breeding grounds of a bird. But once you begin to understand a bird across its entire life cycle, breeding, migration, and wintering grounds, we're starting to discover, wait, maybe this bird we've been conserving is actually most critically threatened on its wintering grounds, and that's really where we should be focusing our efforts.
Give me some examples of, you described some discoveries or information that maybe you hadn't realized before. Give me, if you don't mind, some concrete examples of particular birds in parts of the world that are showing up in these reports that you didn't expect.
Yeah, so every day there are tens of thousands of people going out and finding things that they had no idea that could be there. And so it's something where you go out every day and it's like Christmas almost, where you don't know what's going to be in the next bush. So people have photographed a bird in their backyard that then ended up being the first time it's ever been seen in North America. And that's something that really just happened through eBird.
What bird was that? Just curious.
Yeah, so there's been a recent example is a missel thrush, which is a bird from Europe that turned up in New Brunswick, Canada. And someone just photographed it in their yard, and the news got out, and before long, there were thousands of people flying there from all over the continent trying to see the first missel thrush for North America.
Are there birds that we expected to be driven away by urbanization that are coming back? I'm thinking of the peregrine falcon, although maybe it never left, but are there other examples like that?
Yeah, there are some birds that really do well around humans. So the peregrine falcon example, they used to nest on cliffs and kind of these wild areas. But skyscrapers are the perfect example of a human-made cliff. So they're doing really well. A lot of birds that benefit from bird feeders are doing really well. So northern cardinals, or the flip side of that, the Cooper's hawks that like to prey on songbirds, they love humans and bird feeders because there's a lot more habitat and food for them around suburban areas.
I have to say, although cardinals are beautiful birds, they really irritate me when they're at my bird feeder because they kind of kick everybody out. So the smaller birds, I mean, they're kind of aggressive.
Yeah, they like to rule the roost.
Those and grackles, they're also they're also kind of aggressive, chasing away the prettier birds that I like to see. Here in the Virginia and Maryland area, we get very excited when we see either an oriole or a yellow finch, which comes around only in the springtime. So that's the kind of thing you would expect people to report, right?
Yeah, and that's really the exciting thing, is that there are so many people who have a feeder in their backyard and who really appreciate what they see. And when you can link all of that together around the world, it becomes so powerful. And so on its own, a sighting of a cardinal or a grackle might not contribute too much to the global understanding of birds. But if you have millions and hundreds of millions of sightings, you can begin to understand that, wait, maybe some of the common birds aren't doing as well as we thought. They might be declining, and we really need to understand how that's happening, where it's happening, and how we can fix it.
Are there some birds that conservationists thought were declining, but they just made a nest elsewhere, and they've been discovered through something like the eBird Project?
Yeah, there have definitely been a lot of studies that have kind of focused on conserving a bird. Maybe golden-winged warbler is an example. It's a bird that breeds across much of eastern North America, the Appalachians and kind of the Great Lakes region, and it winters in Central America and Venezuela. And a lot of work had been done on kind of the eastern population of golden-winged warblers, which had been declining drastically. But it seems that some recent research has shown that the Central American populations might not actually be doing as poorly as the ones that winter in Venezuela. And so it's something that's kind of an evolving story, and as we collect more information, we'll be able to understand even more.
When talking about the health of the environment, biologists usually point to amphibians as kind of indicators. But birds, too, might be the canary in the coal mine. Are there some examples of how environmentalists might look to migratory patterns as indicative of what the environment is doing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the phrase you used, canary in the coal mine, is kind of the classic example. The reason why we do study birds here at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and at eBird in general is because they are such amazing environmental indicators. You can learn so much about the ecosystems and the habitat health through birds. So a great example is shorebirds, so sandpipers and plovers that will migrate all the way from the Arctic tundra to South America every year. And they have these critical stopover sites where they might have this one tidal estuary that most of the population will stop at. And if you study the numbers that are stopping over at these sites, all of a sudden you might notice that they're dropping off at one place and increasing at another. And that can be a really good indicator that there's something wrong with the entire health of that ecosystem and estuary.
What are the biggest contributors to the declining numbers of some birds?
Habitat loss is a huge one. So especially in times of concentration for a bird. So some birds might migrate through a very narrow area like Central America or be wintering in the foothills of the Andes, which might be threatened by agriculture or any sort of similar development. In the U.S. and North America, also the development of habitat, but also building collisions, and feral cats are actually two very big impacts that aren't discussed as often as others.
I've actually read recently about not just feral cats, but domestic house cats that people let outside. They're a real danger to neighborhood birds, in the, you know, just your birds in the area, mockingbirds, robins.
Yeah, cats are definitely an impact on birds, and it's a really tough subject because there's a lot of emotional kind of stake in the issue, both from the sides of the conservationists and then the cat owners. So it's really, I don't think there's an easy solution to the potential issue of cats predating birds, but it's one of the many reasons that birds can have trouble throughout their annual cycle.
Is there a part of the area, a part of the world where the decline in certain numbers of species of birds are particularly precarious?
Yeah, there are some areas that have high degrees of endemism, so basically birds that only occur there in the entire world, and they're threatened by human change. One of those classic ones is eastern Brazil, so particularly northeastern Brazil, where there's kind of just very small fragments of the original forest that remains, and some birds are down to double-digit numbers in the entire world. There might just be tens of a species left that occur in one or two forest fragments. And so one of the things that we do at eBird is try and work with local conservation groups to really provide a platform where they can monitor these birds. And so we work with Save Brazil in Brazil, who does great work conserving these species.
What can people do to encourage birds in their environment, in their backyards, on their condo balconies if they have a condo, or if they're living in an urban area? Are there certain things they can do to encourage a little more activity from birds?
Yeah, greenery always helps. So especially in an urban environment where there's so much kind of built environment, it's really valuable to just have a bush or a tree even. And one of the things that's so special about birds is that they're everywhere. And it's really almost a different lens through which to view the world. Once you kind of have your eyes open to birds, you realize that you see them in every tree and bush, every small park in a city. And the diversity and wonder that they can have is pretty powerful.
Are there birds that you're suddenly, you did mention one that they saw in an environment they didn't expect to see in, but are there birds that, because of citizen science, you suddenly realize, well, there are some. There may not be many, but there are some.
Yeah, there's certainly continually new discoveries. So whether it's a new population of a rare species, an entirely new species is certainly not a common thing. But especially in places like South America, where there's still remote mountain ranges and places to explore, every couple years a new species of bird turns up. And so actually in Brazil, again, those same partners at Save Brazil were instrumental in discovering this beautiful bird called a blue-eyed ground dove. Last year, and that was something that had been lost to the world. It was last seen decades ago, and then someone discovered a small population, and stuff like that is really exciting.
Well, do you have a favorite bird? Is there one that you particularly like?
I do, and it changes over time. It's always a tough question. It's a very polarizing question in the birding world. But right now, my favorite bird would be a grandala. Which occurs above treeline in the Himalayan mountains. And it's the most impossibly blue creature that has ever existed. And I'd recommend taking a look for it.
I'm going to have to look it up. I don't know that I'll go to the Himalayas anytime soon, but I would like to look it up. Well, I want to make sure that we have the website where bird enthusiasts across the globe can go and log on and report what they're seeing in their backyards. Can you give it to me?
Try eBird.org or the Merlin Bird ID app, which is a really great way to understand what you're looking at when you're out there birding in the field.
Well, thank you so much, Ian. That's Ian Davies, the eBird Project Coordinator at Cornell University of Ithaca, New York. Our engineers were Joe Gill and Suleiman Tarawali. And I'm Rebecca Ward. Thanks for listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.